tune in to KBOO for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio and Peña Flamenca de Portland are proud to co-sponsor Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. Pepe Rafael of Pepe and the Bottle Blondes will team up with Lily Last of Stomptown Flamenco for an evening of flamenco. Again, that's Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, located at Southeast 2nd Avenue and Madison Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You put a big black blob in the middle of Canada and you reach out a tentacle to every part of the coast. There's a giant octopus that's essentially wrapping its tentacles around North America.
I find it marvelous how people can somehow drive down a 18-lane freeway in their SUV cursing and swearing about products of the oil sands coming to California. As Pogo said, we've seen the enemy and he is us.
This Monday, July 7th, Locus Focus presents a special presentation of a new documentary by Barbara Bernstein. Fighting Goliath is a story about the frenetic exploitation of the Canadian tar sands and its rippling effects across the continent. Tune in on Monday, July 7th from 10 to 11 a.m. to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, 104.3 FM Corvallis, or listen online at kboo.fm.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont, and at Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
It's 8.03 a.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Sitting in, I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and today, author, pundit, and educator Harris Zafar. His new book is Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions. Harris, thank you so much for being on the air with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be on.
Great. Listeners, you know Harris because he is the national spokesperson for the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. And also he is the spokesperson for Muslim youth. Tell us a little bit more about your work, Harris, before we start talking about your amazing book.
Oh, absolutely. So I do serve as national spokesperson for the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, which is a particular organization, a particular sect of Muslims here in the United States. It's one of the oldest Muslim organizations in the United States, established back in 1920. We're founders of the Nationwide Muslims for Peace movement, which is a movement of Muslims it's a grassroots movement that which we get thousands upon thousands of Muslims, men, women, young and old, to take an active role in reaching out to their local neighborhoods and talking about peace, spreading this message of peace. And we try to focus particularly on the youth. And that's in my role as the National Director of Faith Outreach for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community's Youth Association. My focus has been on the young men and youth around the country just to get them, encourage them to speak out about their faith and to be more proud about what their religion truly stands for.
Mm. And Harris, so the book, Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions. Now, a lot of us in the United States today are reeling from the Supreme Court's ruling this week regarding religion and birth control insurance coverage. And I know your book is not about birth control, but religious beliefs in the United States are on the front burner right now. To me, it almost looks like some religious groups get all the religious freedom and others don't get any or as much. So let's jump into your book, Demystifying Islam. What's it about and what brought you to write it now?
Well, I've been, and I mentioned this in the very beginning of the book, is that this is a book that I'm not writing just now. This is really a culmination of a little more than 15 years of my work, in which from just a student to an activist to kind of playing a leadership role within the Muslim community, of speaking with those of other faiths, even speaking with those of other Muslim traditions on what Islam stands for, what are its teachings, any faith, set of philosophies, there are bound to be misunderstandings, confusions, and even disagreements on what's the proper way to interpret the philosophy. And so this book is the result of all the debates, arguments, dialogues, and deep studies that I've had over the course of more than 15 years to truly get into what is the theology of Islam, what are its basic principles, but then also what does the history of Islam and its teachings offer us to clarify some of these confusions on some of the hot button topics, such as jihad. You know, what is this jihad on matters of terrorism or violence in the use of religion, on this concept of Sharia law? What is Sharia? What is Islamic formal governance? On the treatment of women and the rights of women according to Islam, free speech. And we see those things. You see incidents where examples of free speech will incite Muslims to riot. Freedom of religion. Are Muslims allowed to offer others that are non-Muslims freedom to practice their religion? And are Muslims free to convert away from Islam? Even an entire chapter on Jesus in Islam, because many people don't realize the role that Jesus plays in Islam, and even the debate within the Muslim world on the role and the life of Jesus Christ. So this book is my attempt to confront in a very bold fashion what are these hot button issues. And how can we understand Islam's response to these issues?
Hey, if you just tuned in, I'm Lisa Loving. I'm sitting in on Wednesday Talk Radio today. We're live on the phone with Harris Zafar. He is a spokesperson for the United States Ahmadiyya Muslim community. He's part of Portland's Ahmadiyya Muslim community in Southwest Portland. You can find out more about his work at muslimsforpeace.org. But you also have heard Harris going on Fox News and going head-to-head with some real spinning hairdos. I'm putting that out, really spinning people. And Harris, I mean, you're such a feet on the ground guy. And listeners, if you're not familiar with Harris Zafar's work, he really touched off a firestorm by saying that the 9/11 Museum's Al-Qaeda documentary does not tell the truth. Boom, just like that. And he's, Harris, it's hard to sort of back into some of the amazing dialogues and debates that you're having with the real right wing in this country. You really have gone head to head with people like Dinesh D'Souza, Pamela Geller. Does anybody know who Pamela Geller is? Pamela Geller is, I'm going to describe her as an Israeli Jewish activist in America who really becomes infuriated at even the thought that there's anything called a moderate Muslim, which is bizarre to me. So, Harris, talk a little bit about why does this matter? Talk about this issue with the 9/11 Museum. Why does it matter that they're pumping up Islam as if it's... Tell us, what is your take on that documentary that's shown at the 9/11 Museum?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a... It's a short, I believe it's a 7-minute long film that's being shown in the 9/11 or the September 11 Memorial Museum in New York City. Called The Rise of Al-Qaeda. And museum officials screened the film to specific groups before it released, before the opening of the museum, to receive some feedback. And they received very strong critical feedback on how this film apparently, at least maybe not intentionally, but seems to conflate Islam and Muslims and the religion of Islam with the terrorists who brought down the World Trade Center. Now, when I was asked by Fox News then to provide a view on this, obviously I hadn't seen the film. I wasn't part of that interfaith group that was asked to screen the film and then who had expressed all these concerns. But for myself, you know, listening to their account or their review of the film, what really concerned us was not that, you know, there's a film that's talking about Al-Qaeda. I think, in fact, Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11 is very critical to maintaining the history of what happened to us as a country on that day. But what gave us pause was when they started using Arabic terms or Islamic terms, labeling things like Islamic or Islamist or violence, labeling that with the Islamic term jihad, without any type of... explanation given that this is a militant perversion of Islam, that this is not necessarily Islamic, but calling an act Islamic or calling terrorism Islamic, what it does is it conflates what that act of terrorism and lunacy is with the faith of Islam. So that's where you see the right and the left in this country often at complete polar opposites. Some that totally understand our point of view, that, you don't want to conflate a philosophy that's practiced by 1.6 billion people around the world with the ideology that feeds a very small fraction of Muslims around the world to incite them towards hate and violence. But there are those, such as Pamela Geller, such as Dinesh D'Souza, Dinesh D'Souza I was actually quite disappointed in. He had been previously a scholar. He had been recognized as a religious scholar in the past,
and he's a Christian, I believe.
Yes, and in fact, I've enjoyed watching some of his debates when he's representing the Christian faith when he was debating Christopher Hitchens and atheists, but he somehow turned from this polemic Christian author to this political commentator and provocateur. His claim is that the Islamic concept of jihad is a holy war that's waged by Muslims in order to violently spread their faith. And this is just intellectually dishonest, and it's just simply not true. So that's why when I appeared on the Fox News program, you know, besides him, you know, that's what I was, the point I was making was that this is a perversion of Islam that terrorists have perpetuated. And then what the people here in this country, sometimes on the right, at the far right, and other countries do is they take that very perverse, very violent expression of people's political agenda, and they amplify that. They see this is what Islam truly is. And whereas the rest of us peaceful ones are trying to scream on top of our lungs saying, no, that's not what Islam is. We condemn that. We stand next to you, and we condemn such acts of lunacy. And we're cast aside as being a minority fringe.
Listeners, look, Ramadan started last week, and we right now want to reach out to people of the Islamic faith who might be listening this morning and open up the phone lines for your comments on this issue, 503-231-8187. And we do have Joanne on the phone. Joanne, I've missed you. What's going on?
Well, let's see. My old age, I've reached some conclusions. And one of them is that religions and governments and that are used to run and control people's lives. And at the same time, also, I realize there's a lot more to it than that. And also, even though it's probably not connected with this conversation, but I'm going to put it out, I'm still able. You know, whatever patriarchy is, and I think it's I think it's evil and unhealthy, that's my present opinion, that in the back of my mind, I hope that it will be weakened or destroyed, but I'm not counting on it, and I'll leave the air.
Joanne, thanks for calling. Joanne put some stuff on the table, and what we're really kind of looking at are, I mean, Harris, I think part of what we're looking at is the politicization of religious beliefs. You know, when does religion become a political tool to attack people? As Joanne's talking about, machines of control. And what I see you, and now I've watched you for a few years doing your work, I feel as though you're trying to bring some level of, forgive me for using this word, sanity to these discussions. And Dinesh D'Souza's new book is basically, it's called America, and it's basically saying that all of the left, the progressive left, they just hate America. And so if you took their arguments to the logical extreme, what if there was no America anymore? He's kind of trying to justify no one being allowed to criticize the government, kind of. And so it's not the same issue that your book, Demystifying Islam, is about. But what I see you doing with Demystifying Islam is giving people a vessel to just understand the basics that they don't get in these other Fox News and mainstream media conversations. But now, Harris, and we do have another caller, but I want to ask you this really quickly. Listeners, Harris Safar is also a really active blogger on the Huffington Post, and he's got some amazing commentaries on there that I know people want to read about. Harris, you've talked about how to combat Nigeria's Boko Haram. You've talked about Pastor Nadar Kani, the guy who was punished for apostasy for becoming a Christian. You've talked about issues of sexism and violence and Sharia law and stuff like that. And when I read your stuff, I don't feel scared anymore. So I just have to ask you, you know, as you put out all of your commentaries, and Joanne is basically bringing up gender, she's bringing up patriarchy, what do you see as the role, the potential role of Islam in helping people understand the rights of women, the rights of all people? Because I know that's something you specifically have talked about a lot.
Yes, it's a very important issue when half of the world's population can be perceived as living in suppression or repression versus the other half, or they live in fear of being under oppression. And that's not a healthy state to be in. And so that's why I've dedicated an entire chapter of the book to discussing this this area of women's rights in Islam. And it's interesting what Joanne mentioned, because the parts of the world where you see these issues, where you see issues in general arise, those are the parts of the world where it's a very patriarchal society. And so when you hear issues like in Saudi Arabia, women cannot drive or they cannot work, or in different parts like in Sudan or Afghanistan, they can't leave their home without a presence of a male. You know, these are all things that are not only un-Islamic, meaning they're not supported by any Islamic injunction. They're in fact anti-Islamic. I use the word anti-Islam because they actually fundamentally break some core teachings of Islam. Prophet Muhammad's wife, Aisha, was an educator. He even said you can learn half of your faith through her. He didn't say women learn about faith through Aisha. He said to all believers, you can learn half of your faith from Aisha. So if she's an educator and who's teaching people, how can we even imagine that she wouldn't be educated herself? We know that Muhammad's wife even riding on the back of a camel, and so that's their form of transportation. So if she could drive back 1,400 years ago, why do we believe that women can't drive now? So that's where, yeah, it's for us when we see this happening, you know, it's very painful, not only to see fellow human beings oppress women in general, but then to know it's being done under this guise of in the name of their faith, that's extremely painful. And then compounded with that is when I know what Islam says in terms of the amount of respect that's owed towards women, when it says that paradise lies at the feet of your mother, and knowing that every woman is a potential mother, what Islam is telling us is paradise for you lies at the feet of women, meaning how you treat your women, how well do you honor them, how well do you cherish them, how well do you protect them. Knowing that that's the Islamic injunction, to hear what's happening around the world is very frustrating. And the only one other thing I'd like to say about what Joanne mentioned, especially with regards to religion and conflating with politics, I believe that this is what's led to much of the skepticism about religion in general. It's a tendency to mix religion with politics. And then what comes about is this perceived hypocrisy within religions and religious institutions. Because many complain that religions and their leaders spend too much time focusing on administrative matters, on political fighting, and on fighting right versus left, and not enough time organizing and working towards prayer, towards justice for all, and through a rational application of faith in modern times. And so this reflects a decline of religiousness or spirituality that we hear in all these surveys and reports that come out once in a while. So what we try to do is, because we see that religion sometimes is not considered anything to be proud of anymore, because the ultra-religious often seem to be the ultra-close-minded. And I don't believe that's a fair representation of what religion can offer. So this is a gap we're trying to fill today by calling people of conscience towards prayer, towards peace, towards justice and equality, towards this heightened God consciousness and doing good to others. And towards just general human decency, because that's what I believe is Islam, and it's an Islam that many have lost sight of.
Mm. And we are speaking live on the phone with Harris Zafar. His new book, Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions. It's a great book to give to someone who loves to read but doesn't have a lot of information about basic politics and religion in the United States, because this is exactly the kind of background information that you do not get from the nightly news. And I even have to say that some articles in the Oregonian that I've read, I think are pretty misleading. So we have a caller, and listeners, the number to call is 503-231-8187. Let's go to the phone. We have George on the phone. George, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Lisa. Thank you for having this excellent scholar to open our minds on your program. And I want to ask him a question. I will need to quote briefly from a book which he probably has seen. The title of the book is Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terrorism. It is published by Seven Stories Press in New York, and it is by Asad Abu Khalil. And Khalil talks about the 1950s when Nasser, a socialist apparently, sponsored a program widely popular among, I believe, Muslims in the Middle East, and badly frightened the United States and Saudi Arabia, which heard here something that they were deeply set against, which was a democratic, socialist, and feminist agenda. And so he says, Asad Abu Khalil says on page 59 of his book, it was during that political moment that American and Saudi connections began funding and developing various Islamic fronts to fend off the socialist and Arab nationalist dangers. The front groups produced a body of books and pamphlets calling on believers to reject atheistic communism and embrace the path of the good predecessors known as Salaf, hence the name Salafiyah, to refer to modern fundamentalists who want to bring back the glory of the early days of Islam. And I'm saying this looks like a more CIA, U.S. Anti-democratic activism always practiced in the name of democracy and human rights, which is exactly the opposite from democracy and human rights. Have you encountered this view of American funding of fundamentalist religious institutions in the 50s before? And is this some kind of a significant dynamic in the history of the increasing conflict between fundamentalist splinter groups, which call themselves Islamist, and the rest of the world?
Thanks.
And so that's my question. I'll hang up and take my answer off the phone.
Thank you so much for calling, George. Is basically setting us up for the history, Harris. Talk about that history. Do you talk about this in your book, going back to, did United States taxpayer money create some of this problem?
This is a great question. I appreciate George bringing this up. This didn't come up in a direct, explicit way in my book, but I've discussed this in the past, even on Fox News as well. Many don't like talking about this, especially those on the far right, like you had mentioned, Dinesh D'Souza, who basically is alleging that you can't be critical of the U.S. and U.S. history because then you're not patriotic.
Right.
Which reminds me of Sir Oscar Wilde's quote that patriotism is a virtue of the vicious, because they hold on because of the way patriotism is used often. But for me, if you want to be a loyal citizen of a country, you want to see it be the best it can be. And part of that is admitting where the country has made mistakes. And yes, certainly the United States has, I shouldn't say the United States, but the United States government has, for the past several decades, made mistakes in their foreign policy and in the way that they engage those in different parts of the world. They have toppled democratically elected governments, starting with even in Iran, a democratically elected leader in the 50s and 60s who was toppled. His name was Mossadegh, who was toppled by United States intelligence and forces. And then they inserted the Shah as this incredibly brutal dictator who had brutalized his own people. So when people then see that United States is not helping them, that the United States has actually hurt them, that's where we lose trust in the eyes of people around the world. And when it comes to the Taliban and other such groups, when we have on record Ronald Reagan shaking the hands of these freedom fighters who would later become known as Taliban, saying that he was comparing them to the founding fathers of the United States, because this common thought that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so because they had a common enemy with the United States of the Soviet Union, that's where, yes, funding or other types of material or other support was granted, hoping that this was in the best interest of the United States. And so what the problem with that is, this very short-term view of what's in the best interest of the United States actually then has led to some long-term problems. I don't blame the United States for the formation of Taliban or for the formation of Al-Qaeda, but what mistake that our leaders have made in the past is to provide support to them. It's to give them a platform that later on ended up biting us. And so when the Saudi Arabia, which has chosen its official interpretation of Islam to be something that's called the Salafi or the Wahhabi interpretation, which is a very archaic, very brutal, very closed-minded and conservative interpretation, or I would call perversion of Islam, and their funding now allows this to be taught in mosques and madrasas around the world, including here in some places here in the United States, that's an issue. And so that's where we try to find partnerships in communities at government levels in order to protect our own borders and also protect our people by teaching them what are the consequences of this backwards ideology making its way into our country.
And you brought that up, and now I have to revert to a thing I saw on social media yesterday. And it basically says, America invents enemies, then sends in its soldiers to die fighting them. Ronald Reagan meets with Taliban, 1983. U.S. funds arms Taliban in Soviet-Afghan war. Then U.S. forces sent in to occupy Afghanistan. U.S. soldiers die to remove the Taliban. There's Donald Rumsfeld with Saddam Hussein, 1983. U.S. funds arms Iraq during Iran-Iraq war. U.S. forces eventually sent in to occupy Iraq, and U.S. soldiers die there. John McCain sat down with al-Qaeda in 2013. The U.S. funds al-Qaeda in Syrian civil war. And now it's true, Harris, that a lot of eyes are turning towards Syria. I have a couple of friends that are Syrian-American, and they are the biggest fear is that the United States is going to throw its might into their country, because it, in the end, when you just are a human being living on the ground in these countries, it doesn't matter who funds who. There's just death all around, and you can expect innocent people to die. But Harris, I do want to ask you if you have a take on Syria, what's happening in Syria. Barack Obama is trying to propose a $5 billion investment in training the rebels there. Do you have a take on that? Do you have a position on it?
Yes, it's obviously very, very concerning, the things that we are seeing happening in Syria. Actually, our worldwide Khalifa of the Ahmadi Muslim community has been speaking about Syria for quite some time. And with the development now happening with the ISIS, their claim to establish a new Islamic state, their claim to establish a caliphate, and their threats now of trying to attack Rome. That area of the world is a hotbed for chaos and disorder, and it's been that way for a very, very long time. And so when I look at that, it's a very long and detailed conversation, but the way I view that is, like the Khalifa of our community has said, is that what's happening is this lack of peace in that area is entirely due to the lack of justice. That's been either perceived justice or actual justice that's been perpetuated there. And so when people are rising up, it's because they're sick of all the injustices, and no one is really standing up for the rights of the average person and their quest for justice. And so what's happening in Syria and power that this ISIS group is now creating is very concerning. And we are not afraid at all to mention, to say that what the ISIS is doing, this Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, what they're doing is entirely un-Islamic. It runs counter to the true teachings of Islam. It runs counter to what the caliphate is supposed to be, according to the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, of what the caliphate is and how it will be established in the world. What they're doing is not at all in line with what the Prophet had said. So it's a very concerning situation. We do believe that help is needed from worldwide leaders to help establish more peace and order in Syria. Whether or not boots on the ground are going to help, you know, that's a debate that many people can have, and that's less of a religious debate. That's more of a political debate and a strategic debate of what's going to help. Whether or not we agree with sending troops, what we do agree on is something has to happen to stop the growth of the ISIS, and also to help the average Syrian who just wants some peace and order in their society that they haven't had for a very long time.
And so, again, we're speaking with Harris Zafar. He's from the Ahmadiyya Muslim community here in Portland and nationally. His new book is Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Anonymous on the phone. Anonymous, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I'm a Muslim woman. I live in Portland. I'm a Muslim American woman, and I appreciate this radio program, and also I appreciate just the long piece that was just addressed about how the United States often, funds these groups outside of the country and then turns around, and then those same groups become the enemy when it is convenient, when there's politics around resources and that kind of thing. So I didn't want to pull too much away from that. But at the same time, I want to touch about an earlier comment on patriarchy and Islam, because I feel as a Muslim American woman and a Muslim who really looks to the ideological foundation of my faith and how inspirational and powerful that is, and how much that has to offer for all women, or not just women, but women and men, and kind of the, you know, beautiful insights that it has in our nature and how we can live in the world in a peaceful manner, in a very spiritual manner. And so I think that many times now, being here in this country, I feel frustrated because on the one hand, we have to deal with a lot of racism just from ignorant and racist and conservative ideologies. And on the other hand, with the progressive or liberal ideology, there's also a lot of racism, and the racism comes in the form of a very privileged and assumptions based on articles they've read. But the assumptions and the privilege that comes with that all has a sense of racism that is also very frustrating, because I feel that just allowing a Muslim to speak and express what their feelings about their family history and their faith is washed away with so much propaganda that is comes both from the conservative side and the progressive side. And the propaganda that comes from the progressive side often still assumes Islam is, yes, as, you know, Haris mentioned, there is a lot of patriarchy in places that is actually un-Islamic, and is a lot is a major factor of, you know, the socio-political economic history of those places being in a post-colonial state and then moving through, you know, imperialism and all of that. So I know I'm kind of all over the board.
No, I totally, I think you're dotting a lot of T's and crossing a lot. You know what you're doing. It's awesome. Keep going.
Okay. So what I really just want to come to in the end is, you know, living in this country, being American, born here, but also being Muslim and bringing it to myself and, you know, making it about personal connections. I feel that the thing that saddens me the most and really hurts my heart, especially, you know, it is a time of Ramadan, a very spiritual time for us, is that the ability to connect one-on-one with people and just share what our experiences and history are, because I may come from a war-torn part of the world that, you know, might be of conflict, and people may think, oh, you know, your people are about war, about terrorism. But I also know the real feelings of my extended family members. And I also know that with my family, there's great spirituality and there's great love. And there is not a sense of, you know, there's a sense of hurt because we are suffering on both sides. The people in many of these countries are suffering as well. And I'm so appreciative that you discussed earlier that Al-Qaeda is, in fact, you know, friends and past friends with our CIA and FBI and all, you know, Donald Rumsfeld shaking their hands. Yes, that's real. And at the same time, these terrorist groups are created and then they're wreaking havoc in our home countries, and our family members are there. It's like a double suffering, you know. I'm all over the board.
It's true. And your phone is beeping at us. This is what I want to ask you, Anonymous, before you go. For the rest of us that are really ignorant about this issue and people that are flailing around in our privilege and stuff like that, can you recommend a place on the internet or a place in our neighborhoods or some place where we can go to become more educated about this issue that you think is a good idea, Anonymous?
Well, I think it's hard because a lot of the resources that are even in the library, you know, progressive resources, are also very imbued with racism and you know, assumptions about. But I think the main thing that I want to say is people should talk to people and be open to what they have to say and what they want to share about their experience. Like, I, as a person, want to be open to my neighbor, and I want my neighbor to be open to me and to learn from one another and break down all those walls, because all those divisions just break our humanity up. And that's what I want to say. Really, it's about our humanity as a world. We all have humanity, we all have faith, we all have spirituality, we all have diversity. And if we could just have conversations open-hearted from one person to another, just, what is your experience? And for me as well, to ask my neighbor, what's your experience? It breaks down all the walls of whatever I might assume about the labels and political divisions that I want to impose onto that other person out of insecurity. So to create those spaces of opening, maybe go to, I know a lot of mosques here have, you know, iftars, where it's like a community iftar, and they might invite people from just around if you really wanted to be proactive about it. But if you don't want to be proactive about it and you have a Muslim neighbor, maybe just don't assume a lot about them and try to talk to them and treat them like a human. Because I, in wearing a headscarf, have not been treated like a human for the last 10 years of my life. So it's been a very big challenge, because I am human, you know. That's it.
Thank you so much for calling. Some of the smartest words I've heard in a long, long time. That was Anonymous. This is KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Sitting in, I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and we are live on the phone with our guest, Harris Zafar. His new book, Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions. And I think we have another caller. Harry's on the phone. Harry, what's on your mind today?
Oh, welcome back, Lisa. We've missed you.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, the question I have for, in his book, does he mention Obama and how the Republicans played the Muslim race card by screaming he was a Muslim and then looking at his education background, because Obama went to one of these Muslim schools in Indonesia?
And his middle name is Hussein or something?
Yes.
It was all very... What do you think, Harris? That one gets me, too. And Dinesh D'Souza really went for that red meat around whether Obama was really born wherever he's supposed to have been born. Can you address that, Harris? Just the targeting of the president of the United States.
Yes, no, absolutely. This is a common allegation. So it all starts from this accusation that he is a Muslim, that he was born a Muslim. Some even allege that he is a hidden Muslim with this Muslim agenda to make the United States succumb to Islamic rule. What you find when you look into a lot of these theories, these conspiracy theories, is this overarching fear of Islam and fear of Muslims. At least they're perpetuating, they're trying to instill more of a fear of Muslims, and then also just Obama bashing. And not that I'm not a political man, so I don't take sides when it comes to political candidates, at least not publicly. I may inside my heart, but so I'm not here to defend President Obama. But the vitriol with which over the past couple of years the opposing party has interacted with him or has debated with him has been incredibly disappointing. You can disagree with policies, but to basically allege that this person is the worst leader we've ever had, everything he does is wrong, everything he does is stupid, and he does not care about the protection of this country, that alone is enough for me to shake my faith in your credibility. Once you start making those statements, even people that made such statements about the president, former President Bush, would shake my confidence in them. For myself, when I look deeply into the allegations, one of the things that I start feeling, and many Muslims feel, is we are firmly convinced that President Obama has never lived the life of a Muslim. Even in Indonesia, when he went to a school that's called a madrasa, and a madrasa just means school, from the same Semitic origins as the Hebrew madrash, that it's not that he was being taught extremism; that he was just it was in a Muslim majority school. that doesn't make him a Muslim. But then the question becomes, what if he was a Muslim? What if a president was Muslim? What's so bad in that? Is that an allegation to make? It's not, if you're accusing someone of being of sedition, if you're accusing somebody of treason, if you're accusing somebody of those type of things in a political role, I can understand. But if you're accusing someone, no, you're a Muslim. That's not a negative allegation, is it? Should we assume that being a Muslim is not compatible with having a position of authority in a state level, city level, or federal level position? That is problematic. And I think that this is something that we often see, and I think it kind of goes to the anonymous caller, what she was mentioning as well, is that those that we don't know very well, those that we don't see very well, it's often to judge them, to fear them, and then even eventually hate them. This is something that, unfortunately, we've had a track record in this country of doing. It's happened to Jews in this country, where they were vilified. This happened to Catholics in this country, where their loyalty to this country was questioned.
Yeah, a lot of people forget that the Ku Klux Klan hates Catholics, too. Anyway, keep
Absolutely.
Going.
Yeah, and obviously we know what happened to African Americans in this country. To a certain degree, it's happened to Quakers in this country as well. It's sad, but we have to admit that in this country we have had a track record of vilifying a specific group of people, and almost identifying what it means to be an American as being the polar opposite of that group. It often happens in times of economic distress, so there's other factors that go into it. But this is something that we have to confront, that this view that any group is entirely bad or entirely to be untrusted, that is a dangerous mentality. And so I'm kind of combining both Harry's question and the anonymous Muslim caller's question mm-hmm. together. But for us, interfaith tolerance does not mean to not talk about religion because it's uncomfortable. It's exactly what she had mentioned, the anonymous sister, was speaking with one another. Tear down these walls, these barriers between us. You don't have to convert to your neighbor's religion, but at least understand what makes them who they are. That's why we at the Anonymous Community, every Saturday this month at the Portland Rizwan Mosque, we are having open house, what they call iftar dinners, which means every Saturday, 8:30, we'll be meeting at the mosque. We're inviting our friends, our neighbors, strangers alike, to come and we're going to break our fast together. We'll talk about what it means to be Muslim. We'll break our fast. We're going to have a potluck dinner and just break bread with one another and get to know one another and answer questions. And so I hope and I pray that as many of your viewers and listeners as possible would take advantage of this and come to the Portland Rizwan Mosque any Saturday this month. And so that we can begin to understand each other.
All right. And is that Harry that we just lost off the line there? Right on. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I really appreciate the callers today. This is a tough issue. And our guest, Harris Safar, his newest book, Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions. He is, Harris, everybody should have you come and speak to their group because you bring so much to this discussion because you're fearless about trying to jump into these issues like, you know, Nigeria's Boko Haram. So many people were so upset over the kidnapping of all those, the schoolgirls some couple months ago. And yet everybody feels just as powerless about it as we do about global warming. But are we really powerless about it? Or is it the little bubble that's, you know, holding our own minds hostage? And Harris, Ahmadiyya Muslim community, the Rizwan Mosque here in Southwest Portland is the brick and mortar home of your community. And Rizwan Mosque, you guys are really very open. You're always inviting people in, is the sense that I get from you.
Oh yes, absolutely. We have a very open door policy because we believe that when you do things behind closed doors, that for some reason does create suspicion and discomfort in the minds of others. So every Friday when we have our 1:30 weekly prayer service, you know, because Fridays are the main weekly day of service for Muslims, it's an open door. And we often, almost every week, we have guests coming in just to observe, often as students, sometimes just people off the street that want to see what the service is like. There's the fascination with it being the historical mosque in Portland. It was the first mosque ever built in Portland area. And so with that historical value, we welcome anyone to come in and see what it's like and just ask us questions and we'll answer them. I always say that we don't get offended by questions. And once, to give you a perfect example, when I was giving a different type of lecture to a middle school, to an eighth grade class, one of the questions at the end was a young boy who rose his hand and said, yeah, so why do Muslims have to beat their wives? And so I was pretty taken aback, but I wasn't offended because obviously he was told this. He thought it was true. So if that, so here's my chance to demystify and to clarify this little confusion he has. So if that question doesn't offend us, I don't think any question anybody has offended. So that's why we like to have an open door policy to invite our neighbors to come talk to us.
All right. We have a couple callers. I want to say this really quickly, though. People, if you want to look this up, the Rizwan Mosque, it's spelled R-I-Z-W-A-N Mosque, Portland Rizwan Mosque. On their website, they have links and phone numbers that are encouraging people to call and get together and go over there. So I cannot say that every religious community is like that in this country. So, and also Ahmadiyya, it's spelled A-H-M. A-D-I-Y-Y-A. Look it up. Get involved. Plug in. And we have a couple callers. Let's try to go to the phone lines and get these people in. We have Francis. Francis, what are you thinking about today? Thank you for calling.
As-salamu alaykum. I am thinking about the what your last caller spoke of. Our humanity. It's heartbreaking what is happening. And I can remember, I guess I was a fortunate child. When I was about 15 years old, I was raised a Catholic. I went to public high school. And for a project, I did a paper, a term paper, on the pillars of Islam. And I can remember being up late at night trying to finish this paper and reading about the jihad and thinking at the time that it was a beautiful religion. So all these years when I've been hearing this media garbage, I call it, about the jihad, I knew different. I knew it was a spiritual journey. And it breaks my heart that people in our country are not able or allowed to learn about the religion, as you know, and the media hype is outrageous. But what is most heartbreaking, and our Pope, frankly, Pope Francis, is tickling me because he speaks directly to these issues. And when he pretty much was very angry, actually, when he spoke about what's happening in the Middle East, and he called out the warmongers, those who are promoting war, those who are making bank from selling arms and inciting rebellions. And I really don't know how we're going to resolve this. It isn't going to be done, as far as I'm concerned, with more
boots on the ground.
Boots on the ground, as they say. It isn't going to be done by war or conflict. We have to take some kind of way. We're going to have to go to a higher ground. And I think you spoke of President Obama. I think he would really, truly love to be able to do that, but the powers that be in our country right now are not allowing him to do it.
Yeah, he doesn't really run the
racism,
country.
The racism that is being blatantly expressed by people in our Congress is really disheartening.
All right.
But I do believe that we have a way.
All right.
I just don't know what it is yet, but it may be... It's going to have to be pretty darn spiritual, I think.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Francis. Francis, and we do have another caller, but Francis had mentioned that people don't seem able. Sometimes people in our country, we're not able to learn about things. We're not able to learn about religion. We fail at the gaining more information. And I have to say, I was on Huffington Post. I was reading these incredible essays that Harris wrote on the Huffington Post. And then I saw on the right-hand side a video of a baby puppy that was trying to jump on the bed to meet the newborn baby of the family for the first time. I mean, I was so distracted. That's the thing. You go to a news website, you're completely distracted by things. We are constantly distracted. And I think that that's part of it is focus. I think that maybe one of the most important things that we as a people could learn is focus. Let's go to the last caller. We have Brenda on the phone. Brenda, quickly, let's get you in. What's going on with you today?
Hi, I'm in accordance with Francis and what you just said, but I'm so tired of all of this division. I just really wish that people could see that we're all one people. We all praise one God. There's not seven different gods. There's one God. And I just wish we could all come together and just realize that we're all human beings. I mean, it's been said a million times before, I know, but I think, like Francis said, it's going to have to be one heck of a spiritual thing that comes along that will increase our love for humanity and for each other. And if somebody's wearing a head wrap, so what? They're still a human being. I don't understand why people can't treat people for who they are, the color of their skin, not what religion they believe in. Mm-hmm. This is America. We have freedom of religion here. And there is ways to learn about other religions. The internet is full of information that we can learn from. I'm just so tired of all this hatred and this racism and these divisions, and now the governmental level is coming down on us in many different ways, and we're really at a turning point. Really, it's either going to go really well from here or it's going to go really bad, and I just wish we could all just love each other and understand we're all one people. We all praise one God.
All right, Brenda. Thank you so much. Appreciate your calling. And I know that there are people out there that do not believe in a God. And
sure.
You know, we're not even having that debate today. We're just trying to have the discussion that we're having about the Muslim community. So thank you so much, Brenda, for calling.
Yes.
We love you too, Brenda. We're starting to run out of show. We are live on the phone with Haris Zafar, his new book, Demystifying Islam, Tackling the Tough Questions. And there is one really tough question that we haven't even brought up at all, and that is what happened to Mohammed Mohamud, the young man who has just, he's still going to be sentenced for being the so-called Christmas tree bomber in Pioneer Square. And we could have brought him up at the very beginning of the show. When we are talking, people are talking about seeing each other as human beings, not as terrorists or political tools. It's people like that kid that really worry me a lot. I feel as, you know, Haris, and this is part of what you do, is reaching out to Muslim youth and saying, go out and talk about your spirituality and don't be ashamed of it. It does worry me. And I feel as though there's a lot of young people that are in a dangerous place because of the politicization of spirituality that we're talking about now. But we only have a couple minutes left, Haris. We need to bring you back on the air more and more. Tell us, what is the most important thing that people should know about Demystifying Islam, and how can we connect with you and your community to help educate more people about these issues?
The most important thing that I would say about this book, about Demystifying Islam, is this is not a book that attempts to convert you. That's not the end goal. The goal is not to convert people. This book has the explicit and expressed goal of clarifying misunderstandings, clarifying and removing those shrouds of confusion that are muddying the waters and getting in the way of people truly understanding what this faith of Islam and its teachings have to say on these very pertinent issues. So I would invite anyone who wants to understand, even from the basic level to a very advanced and controversial level, Islam, I would invite you to have a read, and whether you agree with it or not, if you want to debate about it, that'd be great. I'd welcome that opportunity to connect. In terms of connecting, of course, you can connect with our community. We have our nationwide, our national website, muslimsforpeace.org. We have our local website, which is just, you know, you can Google for the Portland Ahmadiyya Muslim Community or the Portland Rizwan Mosque. It's just portland.ahmadiyya.us is the website. I'm on Twitter myself, Haris_Zafar. We try to find any and all ways to connect with one another. You can just show up one day at the Portland Rizwan Mosque on any of these Saturdays. We would love to just continue this conversation.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us, Haris. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That's it for our show. Thanks to our guest, Haris Zafar of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community. More on his work at the Huffington Post and at muslimsforpeace.org. Hook up with the Ahmadiyya community at portland.ahmadiyya.us. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky for everything. This show will be podcast on KBOO.FM by the end of today. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
I'm Monica Beamer.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're KBOO's new co-station managers. We're excited to be a part of the KBOO community. We're starting a new weekly feature on Wednesdays at 5:45 p.m. News from the Boo will give you an inside look into what's happening at KBOO, including upcoming events, station news, special programming, and future goals and plans for the station.
Be sure to tune in this Wednesday and every Wednesday after the KBOO Evening News for News from the Boo, an insider look into your community radio station.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for an IT contractor to work with our organization 15 hours a week at $25 an hour. Providing on-site IT support as well as website maintenance support. Essential qualifications include at least 5 years of general IT network and server maintenance and website administration, experience with PHP, MySQL, experience in Drupal 6 and 7, ability to maintain rack-mounted server and maintain a local area network of Windows XP, 7, and 8 workstations. Send a resume and cover letter addressing the above qualifications and the question, why KBOO is important, to hiring@kboo.org or drop it off for IT hiring team at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. More information can be found at kboo.fm/hiring.